Okay, so last week we finished at 1 Samuel chapter 22 and verse 5. What are some of the things that we see that David is facing at this particular time from the verses that we studied up to this point?
Being pursued by Saul, being surrounded by vain men.
That's two of the big things. So number one, of course, the biggest situation he has in his life right now is he's running for his life. King Saul is in pursuit of him, not for any wrong that he's done, but in fact because of his righteousness and his service to God has made him Saul's enemy, because Saul had chosen to reject God and not serve him but disobey him. So Saul had turned against David since God had rejected Saul for his disobedience and chosen David to be his successor as king. So David's on the run, running for his life from Saul. He's got no safe place to go. He's been going from just in the last chapter, chapter 21, he went to Nob because he couldn't stay where he'd been before that, but as Saul was pursuing him. And then he had to leave there, went to the land of the Philistines, to Gath, and he couldn't stay there because they recognized who he was, and he wasn't going to be safe among them as their enemy. So he had to feign craziness to be allowed to leave, and so then he goes and hides in the cave of Adullam back in Israel. And then all of these 400... miscreants and malcontents congregate to him, and he expressed in the Psalms that his soul dwelt among lions, as we read in Psalm 57 and verse 4, these ones whose teeth were spears and arrows and tongue a sharp sword. So this was another source of temptation to him. So he's running and running and running, not safe anywhere. Then he's got a bunch of people that are now around him on a daily basis that have a completely different heart than he does. Now, when David became king, one of the things that we read in the Psalms is how he would not have a wicked man in his presence. He was very diligent to surround himself only with those who love God and were serving God. Well, this is so at odds with who David is and what he stands for, to have to be surrounded by people like this. What can he really do about it? So this was a source of continual. Well, what was the effect that we read in 2 Peter 2 that dwelling in Sodom and Gomorrah, and what did that do to the righteous soul of Lot?
It vexed him daily.
Well, was this a daily vexation to David to be around these people? Certainly so. So those are a couple of things. And what else? What's another issue that we saw there in these first few verses of chapter 22?
His family to be concerned about.
Mm-hmm. The safekeeping of his family. And he had to take his parents over to sojourn in Moab for their safety. His family's not safe. Is David going to feel responsibility there? Is that going to weigh on his mind? And certainly so. So there's some huge issues he's dealing with, and very heavy situations that are very that would be a source of a lot of temptation too. So anyway, David is dealing with all of these things that we see here now up to this point through verse 5 of chapter 22. Yes, Brother Darrell. True. All these things are going to be the growth that he's going through as he comes through all of these trials. Everything that he's going through there, God is going to use to make him better in his service and all the roles that he was going to have throughout the coming days. And certainly that would serve him in his role as King of Israel, dealing with these kinds of matters. Brother Donald.
Verse 2, are these that was in distress and debt and who was discontent, was it discontent with Saul reign?
Well, sir, I mean, looking at the circumstances and the kind of people that were in the description of them, they would they, certainly so, but would they have been content with any ruler or any law? more than likely not. The, I mean, these are the kinds of people. These are the outlaws. These are the people that are that you find out in that are they can't dwell in among society. These are basically your wanted men. So they were living outside the law, and now they congregate to David to be there to follow him as the leader. So this would be your typical band of people that you would find that are out in the dwelling out in the wilderness, and you know this would kind of remind us of our old West. I mean, it's kind of in our modern day. I mean, it's really hard to find. There's really not a place, I guess, in our country very easily where you can just be out in the middle of nowhere. Sometimes people still will do that when they're on the run. Seems like they usually get caught now, but anyway. But this, it wasn't that long ago where this sort of thing was pretty common even in our own country. I know when we were in India, that was, they still had their forest and wilderness areas have a lot of they have names, these brigands as they call them that live out in those areas that are outside the law and exactly this kind of people. So this is what you would find in areas like that. So now they congregate to David, you're our leader now. And so he's having to dwell among people like that. So this would be a source of great vexation that David have to deal with this sort. But anyway, this is not easy circumstances for him in so many areas or realms. But now as we got to verse 6, we saw that the prophet Gad was sent to him by the Lord to... And this is certainly indicative of the advantage that David had over Saul, which is really the advantage that counts. Romans 8, if God be for us, who can be against us? And isn't this the ultimate question for us all? Is who is on our side? Is God on our side? Is God with us or not? Which... that also has, by extension, the question, are we with God or not? Because if we're with Him, if we're for Him, He's going to be on our side. If we draw near to Him, He'll draw near to us. If we forsake Him, He'll forsake us. So that's the ultimate underlying question for all of us in every one of our situations. I mean, are we doing the will of God? Are we serving Him? If so, He's going to be with us. And if He is with us, who can be against us? So no matter what we face, if God is on our side, is God going to work it for our good? Are we going to be given a way of escape from every temptation? Is there going to be a way for us to prevail in the end with God and with His help and His strength? I will never leave you nor forsake you. He tells us, Hebrews 13, 5 and 6. We have so many great and precious promises in the New Testament, right along these lines. But here's an example. All that was happening to David. I mean, is there any reasonable explanation of how this man can even still be alive under the circumstances he's under? I mean, what would be the odds that he could evade the king and his men who are pursuing him like this for as long as he was able to do, and Saul can never get him? I mean, this really... is beyond any rational explanation when you look at it, but we have the explanation here. And of course it is rational. There's a God, and God is with David, and He is not with Saul. So, that's one of the reasons we mentioned the one who's really, even though as we're reading about David and his struggles and we should sympathize with the great, trials and tribulations he was going through, Who's prevailing and who's actually failing in all of this? And Saul is the one that's failing. He's the one that's really losing out because he doesn't have God. David does. So David has a prophet of the Lord sent to him to say, don't stay here anymore. I mean, would Saul be scratching his head? How does he always get away? Well, there's a reason. And if he really stopped and thought about it, why would he even continue the pursuit? He has no chance of getting him. But, of course, he's not listening to any of that, as he's not been listening to anyone or anything from God for a long time now. The closest he came was back there in chapter 19, when for a little bit of time he accepted what Jonathan said and let David come back to his place. But that didn't last, and he's not going to do that again. So David is told by Gad the prophet to leave that hold, and so David departed and came into the forest of Hereth. Did that mean that David could leave that cave and then go and go back to Bethlehem or go back to the king's palace and resume his former position there? Could he be safe again? No, but he wasn't going to be safe where he was. He was going to be discovered there. Likely from this, the word had already gotten out, and it wouldn't be long before Saul and his men would arrive. So, in fact, that's what we're going to read in the very next verse. Saul's going to hear about that David's whereabouts are known. But David's going to be gone when he goes there. But now we're going to see what happens as far as Saul enticing for David to be betrayed. Let's read verses 6 through 10 here in 1 Samuel 22 now. Let's see, Brother Michael, could you read that for us?
When Saul heard that David was discovered, the men that were with him, by Saul rode with him under a tree of Ramah, having a spear in his hand, and all servants were standing about him. And Saul said to the servants that stood about him, "Hear ye now, Benjamites, will the son of Jesse give every one of you fields and vineyards to make all captains of thousands and captains of hundreds? And all of you have conspired against me, and there is none that sheweth me that my son hath made a league with the son of Jesse. There is none of you that is sorry for me, for it sheweth unto me that my son hath stirred up my servant against me, lie awake as at this day." Then answered Doeg the Edomite, which was set over the servants of Saul, said, "I saw the son of Jesse coming to Nob, to Ahimelech the son of Ahithub, and he inquired of the Lord for him, gave him victuals, and gave him the sword of Goliath the Philistine."
All right, so here Saul is using some means to try to enlist some of his supporters and his servants to join the cause with the same zeal that he has in trying to pursue David. What does he use? What means does Saul use to try to motivate people to help him here?
Oh, pity me.
That is a big one there. Don't any of you feel sorry for me? Woe is me. Look at my terrible circumstances here. Yeah, you can see that there in verse 8. His reason for using, trying to get them to pity him is based in a big lie, isn't it? What does he say there? My son has made a league with this David and stirred up my servant against me to lie in wait. Is that true?
No, it has.
Yeah.
It has. Jonathan had made a league with David.
That part was true.
But the other half is false. So that tells us that if someone like Saul say a half truth and think it's to be true, it's not true.
Exactly right. And if he were to speak the whole truth there, he would say that my son has made a league with him to try to stir me up and entice me to follow righteousness like the one he made the league with. But he's not telling the truth, is he? Jonathan has not enticed David to lie in wait, or David has not enticed Jonathan to do anything against him. The two of them are the most righteous men in the land, and everything they've done is to try to encourage Saul to follow the Lord. But he wouldn't listen. So, yes, there's that little grain of truth about the league between Jonathan and David, but what he's The way he's telling the tale here to try to generate the pity is a huge lie. What else does he use to try to motivate these people?
He asks them, you know, what can David do for you that I can't already do?
Well, and how does he refer to them there in verse 7? Hear now ye
Benjamites.
You Benjamites. What's he getting at there? David is of, if he's going to be the next king, then the reign is going to shift from the tribe of Benjamin to that of Judah. So who's going to be left out in the cold then by his reasoning here? See, I'm one of you. I'm a Benjamite. You think this guy from Judah is going to give you the fields and the vineyards and all the good advantages you got with me, a Benjamite, a fellow Benjamite as your king? So there he's appealing to their fleshly connection and then to covetousness. The devil's pulling out all the stops here, isn't he? Using all the classic weapons. I mean, we see the covetousness, the envy, the lies, all of these things that the devil through Saul is using to try to entice these men to do evil, because for them to go along with Saul and trying to destroy David would make them also guilty of doing evil, would it not? Because then they're also joining the persecution of a righteous man. But the devil is having to use all of these lies and subtle and wicked means, his usual devices, to try to enlist these men to go along with wickedness. Brother Donald?
Here, Saul was referring to the family. Another old saying, blood is thicker than water. In other words, he appealed to, I am part, you are part of this family, the Benjamite. So you've got to stick with me no matter what.
Right. But is this appealing to the flesh or the spirit?
Flesh.
Yep. Does the devil use these same means today? Does he divide men on the basis of these outward or fleshly things to get us to identify with these kinds of things? Does he appeal to those baser motives? Identify with your family, with all of these things of who we are in a physical sense. He definitely is very successful still using that. What about covetousness and envy and go along with whoever's going to be able to do, who's going to be able to do the most for you? You scratch my back, I'll scratch yours. And all of it, I mean, the same, what the devil's doing here, he's still doing today very effectively.
You know, we find this in the church. The question is, how does this affect the body of Christ when we have members or families that control a congregation?
If we're going to line up on that kind of basis, then we're going to be judging unrighteously, and we're ultimately not going to be doing right, because if we're not following what God says and what He teaches, where He tells us that we're not supposed to respect faces, we're not supposed to line up on a or make our allegiances based on these outward things. If we do that, and if we're doing things for these reasons that are being appealed to right here to these men, we're going to be wrong like they were. So this is why we bring up the point, or why the Lord is certainly bringing up the point here and teaching us by these examples. Look at what the devil did and how he got people to go along with evil. I mean, do we ever wonder, how could somebody do such a thing? Well, this is how they can do such a thing, because they are appealed to on these kinds of lines or reasons, and they go along with it. So the question is, what are we doing to make sure we don't end up doing such a thing, wicked things, because of allowing the devil to get us to think the wrong way about things and to be looking at things ultimately in a fleshly sense instead of after what is spiritual and according to what God says. So who's the one that speaks up to be the big hero for Saul here? And yeah, and isn't it interesting, it's not even an Israelite here. Doeg the Edomite, who had been set over Saul's servants. Now, who was over Saul's servants for a time?
David.
Hadn't David been? Look at the difference. Who Saul had working for him before, and now who he's got working for him. Could the hearts be any different between David and Doeg?
Edomite was an enemy of Judah.
Well, they were. I mean, these were the children of Saul, and these were ones. Now, God had forbidden them to destroy and take away the land because He had given that inheritance to these children of Esau. But I mean, when the Israelites came up through that area. On their way to the east side of the Jordan River, when God said, don't attack them or take their land. I've given this to them for an inheritance. What did they ask for as they passed through before they came into Canaan?
Water.
Yeah. And what was their answer?
No.
They were... And repeatedly after that time, from the time that Israel gets into their land, how often do we see conflict between the Edomites and the Israelites? And that will continue to be the case. We're going to see more and more examples of this as we go through the study of these other books of the Kings. So this is not an isolated incident, but yet here's one of them that Saul has, not only... as part of his retinue of servants, but he's over his servants. Michael?
Quick question. Doeg had advanced quickly and ranked him, because it said that he was a chief sheep herder, and now he's over the servants.
Yeah, and now whether that's, that may be back in chapter 21 and verse 7 when it calls him the chiefest of the herdmen, that belonged to Saul. That may be the particular types of servants that he was. It may not have been over all, but I mean, he had a very high position, clearly, there in service to Saul. So, and we don't have all the details of his duties, but I mean, you can see that bit in verse 7, and then this in chapter 22 and verse 9. But clearly, he's got a high position under Saul, and. I mean, there's no mention of him before, so it certainly suggests that there's been an ascendancy or an advancement in his standing or position here in a pretty short period of time. But he's the one that steps up and says, "I saw the son of Jesse coming to Nob to Ahimelech, the son of Ahitub." Well, that goes back to chapter 21. He was there. As it told us there in verse 7 at that time. And so he did know that David had come there. And so he speaks up about it now and then says, he inquired of the Lord for him, speaking of Ahimelech. He asked Jehovah, sought Jehovah for on his behalf and gave him food, gave him the sword of Goliath the Philistine. Now, is Doeg speaking the truth or lies?
Have the truth again. He was there and gave him those things, but he didn't require the Lord for him.
The basic point that Ahimelech was trying to help David and doing these things to help him, I mean, was true. But what's the problem here? What was wrong with Ahimelech doing that? Would that have been right or wrong for Ahimelech to help David in those ways? He was afraid to do it because of exactly what's about to happen. But for him to help a righteous man that God had anointed to be king over Israel because he had a heart like God's, who is on the run from a wicked man who's rejected the Lord and the Lord has therefore rejected him, for him to help a righteous man who's being persecuted, is that a wrong thing? No. So what Doeg says is essentially true, but the question is, well, what's wrong with that? Did Ahimelech do wrong in this? And now that's going to be the judgment, that he was guilty of treason, of wrongdoing, that ultimate wrongdoing, by helping David. That's Saul's judgment, and he's going to then have him and all these others destroyed because of that. He's going to consider him worthy of death for what he had done. But now Ahimelech is going to be facing, he's going to end up losing his life because of what he did for David. But what he did was actually the right thing. So he's going to be persecuted himself and killed for it. So Saul is going to now call for Ahimelech, and we're going to see a very dark point, very low point. I don't know if we're going to have to see a lower point for Saul and his actions, but we're going to see how far he's willing to go as far as stooping to wickedness in all of this. Brother Michael? I know it would almost be like back in the Cold War if you'd had a Russian that was on the Joint Chiefs of Staff or something like that. I mean, it just really is perplexing to see with what the situation was for Israel in terms of the relations with Edom, to find one of them in occupying such a high position with Saul. It's true. It's very... very perplexing to see that. But, Brother Hugh?
I was just going to mention that, of course, God needed someone evil there to carry out the...
Yes.
He cursed against Eli and his descendants, just like he needed a lying spirit to get... he may have been to battle.
And therein is really the ultimate answer. I mean, how would you have somebody as wicked as Judas to be chosen as one of Jesus' apostles? Well, there was a work that had to be done. It was even prophesied about. Jesus understood that. He didn't make a mistake in choosing Judas. Now, in this case, would this be according to Saul's knowledge and plans that he was doing in selecting this one? Or is this something that God has worked to get this particular individual? Because here again, we have prophecy coming in. Goes back to Eli's days, what was going to happen to the house of Eli. How many Israelites, as wicked as Saul is being here, how many Israelites would be willing to lift up a sword and destroy the priests of God like this? In fact, how many are we going to see willing to? Even with all the enticements and with all the pressure from King Saul, how many Israelites are going to be willing to do this deed?
Not one.
So in that sense, yeah, it defies any earthly reasoning that there would be an Edomite in this position under Saul here. But yet we can see how God would have worked this to enable him to be in that position, because an Israelite wouldn't do this. So it takes an Edomite that would have this kind of daring to be willing to do that. But who is the one that's commanding it? It's Saul. So you do have the one Israelite who's responsible for it and renders that judgment. Doeg is going to be the one willing to actually carry it out and do that. This kind of reminds us of some of the atrocities in modern times that have occurred. And is he going to be able to take the excuse, "I was following orders"? He was, but that wasn't an excuse. How many others could have followed the order but wouldn't, because they knew this is whatever they could rationalize concerning pursuing David on Saul's behalf? is there any way that anybody can rationalize this? I mean, to slaughter this many people that were innocent, and clearly so, they can't, and the priests of God, they can't do it. But this one guy is going to do that. But is this an excuse? Well, my boss said to. No.
We have two mindsets. The Israelites, they call him God. The law of Moses and commandments and such. Another thing, the Levite priest was designated to serve the temple. On the other hand, we have the Edomites. They don't serve God. They serve idols.
Yeah.
They have nothing but a thing.
This would have no meaning to Doeg, to an Edomite, and clearly so. But yes, there's definitely something about that. An Israelite is going to recognize that this is something that shouldn't be done. Even these ones that aren't doing right in so many other ways, this is something they're not willing. They're not willing to go this far. Saul is, and Doeg is, of course, Doeg being a foreigner. Well, here we have this very, very terrible situation to come to pass in these next few verses, 11 through 19. Brother Peter, could you read that for us, 11 to 19?
Then the king sent to call Ahimelech, the priest, the son of Ahitub, and all his father's house, the priests that were in Nob. And he came all of them to the king. And Saul said, "Hear now, thou son of Ahitub." And he answered, "Here I am, my lord." And Saul said unto him, "Why have ye conspired against me, thou the son of Jesse, and that thou hast given him bread and sword, and hast inquired of the Lord for him, that he should rise against me to lie in wait at this day?" And Elimelech answered the king and said, "Also, who is so faithful among all the servants as David, which is the king's son in law, and goeth at thy bidding, and is honorable in thy house? Did I then begin to inquire about him? He is far from me. Let not the king impute anything unto his servant, nor to all the house of my father, for thy servant do nothing of all this, just or more." And the king said, Thou shalt surely die, Ahimelech, thou and all thy father's house. And the king said unto the footmen that stood about him, "Turn and slay the priests of the Lord, because their hand also was with David, because they knew that he fled and did not show it to me." But the servants of the king would not put forth their hand to fall upon the priests of the Lord. And the king said to Doeg, "Turn thou and fall upon the priests." Doeg the Edomite turned and fell upon the priests and slew them that day 85 persons that did wear a linen ephod. And Nob, the city of the priests, smote he with the edge of the sword, both men and women, children and suckling, oxen and asses, and sheep with the edge of the sword.
All right, so when he called for the priest there and all of those ones there in Nob, and all of these, of course, were of the house of Eli. So the priesthood still at this point is of the house of Eli. And here they all come, they're called there, and Ahimelech comes to him, and he said, "Here am I, my lord." And so then he questions, "Why have you conspired against me? You and the son of Jesse." Well, had they conspired against Saul? No conspiracy against Saul. There's a conspiracy here afoot, but it's from Saul against David. He's got that completely backwards. There's no conspiracy of David against Saul. He's repeating the same lie that he was telling back there in verse 9. Or verse 8 rather. This isn't true at all. But he says, giving him food and a sword, inquiring of the Lord for him, is equivalent to a conspiracy against Saul by his judgment there. And then Ahimelech points out the truth that Jonathan had pointed out to him before. "Who is so faithful among all your servants as David, which is the king's son-in-law, and goes at your bidding and is honorable in your house?" And then, of course, he disputes that point. "Did I then begin to inquire God for him? Be it far from me." But he's speaking the truth there when he says, who's more faithful of all your servants? And what's the point there? And he says, I didn't know anything else about any other situation, less or more. But Ahimelech, what he's saying about David, is it true or false? But he's not going to listen to him. If he's going to cast a javelin at his own son Jonathan, is he going to listen to the same reasoning from this guy? No.
Saul, I think it's very evident that Saul is beyond any type of reasoning now.
Yeah.
When he threw the spear at Jonathan, that was kind of like, I'm not listening to anybody anymore.
Nope. And he doesn't. The only time that we see it from that point on is the two times when his own life could easily have been taken. That's the only time that he admits, even briefly, what the truth is about this whole situation. But it doesn't last, does it? He goes right back to where he was very quickly. Otherwise, he won't acknowledge it at all.
And of course, Ahimelech, from his point of view, David comes to him and says, I'm in the king's business. So in other words, he's saying, I have the name of the king
in
my presence. And so Doeg takes it out, and Doeg knew that part of the conversation or not. But you can see at least what appears on the surface is not really true, whether he held it back or he misinterpreted what he saw.
Right. But he, at the very least, he knows he helped him, and anybody that's helping the king's enemy has got to be wrong, at least so it goes by this reasoning. But Ahimelech, what could he do? I mean, this is Saul's best servant that comes to him. He has been anointed king. At least the word spread enough now. Even the Philistines said, isn't this the one that is to be king? So enough has come, and we're going to see the same thing in chapter 25. Abigail says it. Jonathan knows it. I mean, the word is out, really. So for Ahimelech to be helping a righteous man that God has anointed to be the next king of Israel and is doing nothing against, that man is not doing anything against Saul. Even when he has the opportunity to kill him, he won't. But Ahimelech helping somebody who's trying to escape with his life, and giving him food and a sword, not to be used even against Saul. What wrong thing has been done here by any of them? David hasn't done anything wrong, and Ahimelech hasn't either. But is he going to listen to any of this? No. And so he says in verse 16, "You will surely die, Ahimelech, you and all your father's house." He then commands his men to turn and says, slay the priests of the Lord. And he uses that word Yahweh, the priests of Jehovah, because their hand also is with David. How were they guilty? It says, because they knew when he fled and did not show it to me. Now, who's the one that's going to carry out the sentence on that basis? Doeg. Now, do you detect any irony or hypocrisy in this? Who also was there at the time, knew about it, and didn't say anything about it until right now? Doeg. So, I mean, on this basis, with this judgment, how is Doeg any less worthy of that same sentence than the ones he's going to be killing? How does he rationalize that one? Well, I told finally. this is not righteous judgment. No matter what angle you look at it from, there's so many wrong things about this. So he commands his servants to do it on that basis because they knew that he'd been here and they didn't tell me about it. They kept their mouths shut, so they didn't help me by betraying a righteous man, David. His servants refused to do it. They wouldn't put forth their hand to fall upon the priests of the Lord. So then he commanded Doeg to do it, and he did it. How many fell?
85.
85. What kind of a deed is this to kill 85 of the Lord's priests? And were all these wicked? And there's nothing there to suggest that. Eli's sons were. They had already met their judgment. But was God's prophecy against the house of Eli? We know the reasons why, going back to chapters 2 and 3. But was it a judgment to say that everybody in Eli's family and all the priests were wicked? No, but God did make the decision because of what Eli had done. He was going to change the priesthood from Eli's house to another of the families of the children of Aaron that was more righteous, that was faithful, that would be worthy of that. Eli was no longer, and that family was no longer worthy based on what we already read that had happened from Eli. By God's verdict, they weren't worthy. He wasn't worthy for that priesthood to continue in his family. So God made the decision, I'm going to change it. And Zadok is going to be the one that is going to ultimately be given the priesthood. That's going to finally transpire under King Solomon after David's death. But this doesn't mean that there weren't any righteous ones that were in Eli's family. But how could, as long as you have, and there's still Eli, obviously this is a large family. And when you consider, I mean, Eli was part of it, but how many of his brothers, I mean, nephews, etc. I mean, how many would there have been that would have been, how many members of Eli's family would have been, males were there that were serving in the priesthood? Therefore, how many eligible people were there to ascend to the position of high priest? What would have to happen in order for the position of high priest to be taken completely out of that entire family to another? It's going to require no survivors from the family. So this is going to be part of what is necessary to occur in order for God's word, for his judgment to be carried out and his word to be fulfilled. That doesn't mean that all the ones that are that suffer the consequences of this are being punished for their own wrongdoing. But this does bring up another question. Do we ever see somebody does something wicked, somebody else will suffer adverse consequences as a result of that? Something wrong somebody else has done. Does that happen? Now where this can get tricky or difficult as far as understanding or discernment is recognizing the difference between, well, somebody has done something wrong, I'm suffering because of the wrong they've done, versus I'm being punished and judged by God as guilty of wrongdoing myself when something bad happens to me. Is there a difference between those two things?
Yes.
Big difference. The Israelites had that proverb that we read about in Ezekiel chapter 18. The fathers have eaten sour grapes and the children's teeth have been set on edge. That was their way of saying, we've done no wrong. We're being punished as guilty of doing evil when we didn't do it. It was our fathers that did it, which that itself was a lie. They also were guilty of wrongdoing. But aside from that point, the entire proverb was wrong. And the whole 18th chapter of the book of Ezekiel is dedicated to that teaching against and refuting that false doctrine, which is what that was, because it was saying that God was judging somebody of guilt for another person's sins. God doesn't do that. And he says the soul that sins, it will die. When it comes to God's judgment and whom he is going to pardon, whom he is not, it's not going to be on the basis of somebody else's works. We're all going to be judged according to our own works, and the New Testament teaches the same thing. What does that do with the doctrine of so-called original sin, those things that say that we're born into this world stained with the guilt of Adam's sin? Are we at any point stained with the guilt of somebody else's sin? No, we're not. Not according to the teachings of the Bible, Old and New Testaments. I mean, it's consistent all the way through. That's not the case. Romans 5:12, when he talks about Adam, and he says that so death passed upon all men, starting from Adam, for that all have sinned, is the statement there. So what happened to Adam, spiritual death, separation from God because he sinned, has also happened to us, but not because Adam did it. It's because we did the same thing. We also sinned and therefore suffered the same consequences that Adam did because he sinned. So the same consequence has befallen us in terms of God's judgment because of the same thing. It's not because somebody else did, it's because we did. Of course, the Lord has given us the opportunity to repent of those things, and he's willing to forgive us through Christ, which is where we have all of our hope for reconciliation and salvation and all those great blessings that are there. But ultimately, we're going to be judged according to our own works. But does that mean nothing bad is ever going to happen to us because somebody else has done something wrong and chosen to? Happens all the time. I mean, it's a regular occurrence for I mean, anytime somebody... If somebody steals, well, somebody got stolen from, didn't they? You ever had something stolen from you? That mean God was judging you as the guilt of with the guilt of being a thief? No, the other person stole, but you're the victim. I mean, are we ever victims of somebody else's wrongdoings? Happens a lot. Brother Donald?
Job answered that question over the Job about a righteous suffering.
Mm-hmm.
Not because if he has sinned, because of the sins of others bring the suffering upon the righteous.
And there, we know that God has many reasons why this is necessary for these kinds of things to happen, and even for those who are innocent to suffer evil things. The promise, the ultimate promise we have from God is that he's going to work it for our good. He has a good purpose that he's going to work for his faithful servants. But, I mean, what's going to end up happening to Jonathan at the end of this book? He's going to die in battle. But it's not a punishment of wickedness. But this is all necessary in terms of God's ultimate plans for what's going to happen. In Israel with David to be the king. But in a similar way here, not only are you having the kingship changing from the house of Benjamin to the house of Judah, but you're having the priesthood changing from the house of Eli to the house of Zadok. Similar things are going to end up happening in both situations as part of what's going to have to happen for that to transpire and to be accepted by everybody. There aren't going to be many left in the house of Saul, right? Now, it's not because David decided they had to die, but they weren't going to accept the kingship being taken. So they rebelled and fought for it. And when they did that, they lost. But in this case, the house of Eli, as God prophesied, there weren't going to be any old ones in the house. Didn't mean they were being stained with the guilt of Eli or Eli's sons, but they were going to suffer some things as far as bringing this to pass. But this is all part of the fulfillment of what God had prophesied back in the days of Eli. Just to remind us of that, in chapter 2, 31 to 33 of this same book, 1 Samuel, God said, "Behold, the days come that I will cut off thine arm and the arm of thy father's house," is what he said to Eli, "that there shall not be an old man in thine house. And thou shalt see an enemy in my habitation and all the wealth which God shall give Israel. For there shall not be an old man in thine house forever. And the man of thine whom I shall not cut off from mine altar shall be to consume thine eyes and to grieve thine heart. And all the increase of thine house shall die in the flower of their age." Now that happened to Hophni and Phinehas, his two sons, first in 1 Samuel chapter 4. Then, of course, when Eli heard that news, he himself fell backwards out of his chair, broke his neck, and died. And also then the wife of Phinehas, when she heard that her husband and her father-in-law were dead and the Ark of the Covenant had been taken, by the Philistines. She went into premature labor, and she died, in, also in 1 Samuel chapter 4. The high priesthood eventually passed to Ahiah, who was the son. Phinehas' son was Ahitub. And we don't know what happened to Ahitub or Ahiah, but then it did. Ahiah's brother was this Ahimelech that we're reading about here. So if you want to actually, if you want to trace the genealogy here, we have Eli, Phinehas, his son, Ahitub, his son, and then Ahitub's sons, Ahiah and Ahimelech, both of whom served as high priest. Ahimelech is the one that's high priest right now, but he's killed here. There's one survivor, Ahimelech's son, Abiathar. So we can see he's also a member of the house of Eli. He's going to serve David as priest for the rest of his time. But then he's going to back the wrong horse, so to speak, at the very end of David's life. Not accepting God's decision for Solomon to be the successor, but instead he supports his brother. But that's going to cause him to be taken out. The last one. He's not killed, but he's sent off back home, removing the priesthood. But he's the sole survivor. So this is really bringing it down to the point where it is now ready for that to change to another household of the sons of Aaron, and it will be Zadok's. So this was all part of the fulfillment of God's prophecy concerning the house of Eli. But it was a wicked man that did it. I mean, it didn't mean that when God said this is what was going to happen, that whoever made it happen was going to be doing right. Doeg is certainly, and Saul are guilty of great sin here in this chapter in commanding and carrying out this command to do this deed. All right, so 85 fell by the edge of the sword. He destroyed everybody, down to the babies, all their animals, everything. Is he trying to make a lesson or an example out of them? So anybody at any point, anywhere, everybody's going to know about this. Is anybody going to want to help David now? If you do, you're going to get wiped out. So certainly he's trying to send a message but the real message is, here's how far I'm willing to go in doing evil against this righteous man. So beware of anybody righteous in Israel now has the great warning. You're in danger if you do right. Very sad. Lord willing, we'll continue on here. At verse 20, we do have four more verses of chapter 22 to cover, and then we'll get into chapter 23, Lord willing, next week. So be back then if you can. And as we close this morning, let's see, Brother Peter, would you lead us in prayer?